Welcome back to the deep dive. I'm gonna start today by asking for just a little bit of trust.
Uh-oh. That's usually a warning sign.
Yeah, I know, right?
Great.
Because today we are going to attempt something that, usually results in a headache. Or a nap.
Or a full-blown existential crisis.
Exactly. We are going to try to break the way you perceive reality, and then, you know, fingers crossed, we're going to put it back together in a configuration that actually makes more sense than the one you started with.
That is a massive promise to make right out of the gate. I mean, usually we promise to make you smarter or more informed on a topic, but promising to reconfigure someone's perception of reality, that's a tall order.
It is. But looking at the stack of research we have on the table today, from Victorian geometry to quantum physics to some very heavy modern philosophy, I think it's a fair goal.
Yeah, we aren't just dealing with facts today. We're dealing with the actual machinery of how we process facts.
We are. And to get us started to sort of grease the wheels of this machine, I want to run a simulation. I want you, the listener, to visualize something with me.
If you're driving, please keep your eyes on the road.
Yes, please do. But let your mind wander into this image. Imagine you're a passenger on a train, a high-speed bullet train. And here's the kicker. You have been on this train your entire life.
You were born in seat 4A.
Right. You took your first steps in the aisle.
So this train isn't just a vehicle. It's your entire environment. It's your universe.
Exactly. You're looking out the window, and the world is rushing by in this blurry smear of color and motion. But here's the specific detail I want you to focus on. Every single time this train approaches a level crossing, where the tracks cross a road, the barriers go down.
You know the drill? The bells ring, the red lights flash, and those wooden arms lower to block the road.
Because the train itself triggers them.
Right. The sensors down the line detect the train coming. The system activates, and it shuts the road to keep cars safe. It's just a mechanical cause and effect.
Correct. But you, the passenger, you don't know that.
No, you've never read the engineering manual.
You just look out the window. And in your entire life, decades of looking out that window, every single time you have seen a road crossing, the barriers have been down. So here's the question. In your reality, in your mental model of the universe, does the concept of an open barrier even exist?
No.
Yeah.
It can't. If you're strictly empirical, if you only believe what you see, then a barrier is by definition a closed object. It's a wall.
Right.
The idea of an open road where cars just drive across the tracks freely, that's not just rare to you. It's physically impossible. It's a fantasy.
Yeah, you would create a law of nature. All barriers are strictly horizontal and block the path.
That's all the data you have.
Now, that vivid, slightly claustrophobic imagery, it comes from one of our key sources today. It's a collection of philosophical essays by H.G.H.J. Stolting called The Holoscript.
Yes.
And it sets the stage perfectly because the premise of today's deep dive is that we are all that passenger. Mm. We are trapped inside a perception system, what Stolting calls a holoscript, that shapes everything we see before we even know we're seeing it.
We think we're seeing the world, but we're really just seeing the barriers, our train triggers.
And the mission today is to try and stop the train.
Or at least to help you realize you're sitting on one.
Mm.
We want to understand the difference between the world, which is that system of categories and closed barriers we see from the window, and reality, which is the raw, unfiltered landscape outside that we can never quite touch directly.
And to do that, we have pulled together a fascinating, honestly, almost bizarre combination of sources. This isn't your standard reading list.
Not at all. We're sort of triangulating the truth here. We have a Victorian novella about geometry from 1884.
Flatland, an absolute classic. I read it in college, and I thought it was just a funny story about shapes, but it's so much more.
It really is. Then we have the absolute mind-bending physics of quantum mechanics, specifically focusing on how it breaks our logical rules and how it relates to dimensional theory.
And we have these modern philosophical essays on the holoscript and the origin of evil.
It sounds like a strange mixed geometry, subatomic particles, and moral philosophy, but they actually all connect.
They connect through the concept of dimension.
Exactly. It's about understanding limits. It's about realizing that just because you can't see something doesn't mean it's not hovering right above your head.
So let's tone set for a second. We are going to explain quantum physics today. But I promise, no math headaches.
No chalkboard equations.
We're going to treat it like we're explaining quantum concepts to a beginner who is already familiar with 3D analogies. We're going to keep this grounded in analogy so you can actually visualize what's happening.
Which is exactly where we should start, with Flatland.
Mm.
Because before we can understand the electron, we have to understand the square.
Okay, let's unpack Flatland, a romance of many dimensions. This book was written way back in 1884 by Edwin Abbott Abbott.
Great name.
Right. And frankly, for a book written by a Victorian schoolmaster, it is surprisingly trippy. It's like Alice in Wonderland meets Euclidean geometry.
It really is. Abbott was a mathematician and a theologian, which is an interesting combination.
Well,
On the surface, the book is a biting satire of Victorian social hierarchy. But underneath that satire, it's a brilliant thought experiment that physicists still use today to explain the concept of higher dimensions to students.
so walk us into this world. If I woke up in Flatland, what does it look like?
Imagine a giant sheet of paper, infinite in length and width, but with absolutely zero height. The inhabitants are geometric shapes sliding around on this surface. They're the Flatlanders.
Like a game of air hockey.
Kind of, yeah. But they have no concept of up or down. Those words do not exist in their dictionary.
And biology is geometry here. Your shape determines your job, your status, your intelligence, everything.
Strictly. It's a rigid caste system. At the very bottom, you have the women who are just straight lines. Then the working class men are isosceles triangles, the ones with two equal sides and a sharp, narrow point.
And the book makes a point that these are, well, they're dangerous, right? Because they're sharp.
Extremely. If a working class triangle bumps into you,
He punctures you. He's a walking weapon.
exactly. So they have strict laws about their movement, and they have to wobble when they walk so you can see them coming. Then as you go up the social ladder, your sides get more equal and more numerous. The middle class are equilateral triangles. Professionals like lawyers are squares,
And the nobility.
polygons, with six, seven, eight sides. And eventually you get to the priests, who have so many sides, they appear to be perfect circles.
Now, the part of the book that always messes with my head is the perspective, because
Well.
we're looking down on the sheet of paper right now in our minds, so we see the shapes. But if I am a square in Flatland and I look at you and you're a triangle, I don't see a triangle, do
No,
I?
you don't.
Yeah.
Think about it. If you put a coin on a table and put your eye right down to the table level, what do you see?
I see the edge, just a line.
Exactly. In Flatland, everyone sees everyone else as a straight line. They have to rely on very subtle visual cues, like how the line fades in the fog, to figure out who is who.
Oh, right, the fog.
Yeah, they say, oh, the center of that line is bright and the edges are dim, so that must be a triangle coming at me point first. It's a world of constant interpretation. They're never seeing the full reality of the shape. They're inferring it from a slice.
It sounds exhausting. But Abbott doesn't stop there. He describes worlds below Flatland to show how perspective works.
But he takes us to Lineland, a one-dimensional world. It's just a single, infinite line. The king of Lineland is a point. He can only see dots. He cannot move left or right, only forward or backward along his track.
Like a bead on a wire.
Yes. If you try to explain left or right to him, he thinks you're speaking gibberish. He thinks you're insane.
And below that is Pointland.
The abyss of zero dimensions. No length, no width, no height. The inhabitant of Pointland is just a point. He thinks he's the entire universe because there is nothing outside of him. He's his own world, his own god. It's the ultimate solipsism.
So we have this ladder of awareness. The point knows nothing but himself. The Linelander knows forward and backward. The Flatlander knows left, right, forward, backward. But the story really kicks off when our protagonist, a square, who is a lawyer and a very practical, logical guy, gets a visit from a stranger from Spaceland.
The third dimension. A sphere visits Flatland.
Now, I want to slow down here because this is the crucial analogy for everything else we're going to discuss regarding physics. The sphere enters the 2D plane. What does the square actually experience? He's sitting in his living room, doors locked.
Confusion, terror. Imagine you're the square. You're sitting in your locked living room. Suddenly, a point appears in the middle of the room, just pops into existence from nowhere.
Because the sphere just touched the paper.
Right. Then, as the sphere moves down through the paper, that point expands into a small circle. The circle gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it reaches the sphere's equator, the widest part.
And
Then it starts shrinking again, smaller, smaller, back to a point and pop. Gone.
to the square, this is a ghost story. It's magic. A shape appeared from nothing, changed its size, which is biologically impossible in Flatland because shapes are fixed, and then vanished into thin air.
And the dialogue here is fantastic. The sphere speaks to the square. He says, I am not a circle. I am a sphere. I consist of infinite circles stacked on top of each other.
And the square says, okay, show me.
And the sphere says, I can't. You don't have the eyes for it.
The sphere tries to explain where he comes from. He says, I came from up. The square says, you mean north. The sphere says, no, not north. Up, upwards, not northwards.
The square literally cannot compute this. His entire reality is length and width. Height isn't just unknown, it's forbidden. It's a direction that doesn't exist in his source code. It's like telling a human to point in the direction of Blurple.
Blurple, right. It's not a thing.
And this is where we pivot. This is the aha moment of the deep dive. The square is us.
We are the 3D beings.
We are. We think we see the whole world. We have height, width, and depth. We look at the Flatlanders and think, oh, you poor limited creatures. But the sphere. The sphere represents the things in our universe that we cannot visualize, specifically quantum mechanics.
I love that framing. That perfectly hits our focus today. So we are 3D beings trying to comprehend a reality, the quantum reality that operates on rules we just cannot visualize because we don't have the dimensional access.
Precisely. We are trapped in our classical view of the world. Newton's laws, gravity, solid objects hitting each other, just like the square is trapped in his flat view. And when quantum phenomena pass through our reality, they look just as spooky to us as the sphere did to the square.
So let's get into the spookiness. Let's look at the sphere passing through our room right now. We have our source on quantum mechanics, which, let's be honest, is usually a headache to read. But using the flatland analogy, I think we can crack it for anyone.
But do it.
Start with superposition. This is the one everyone knows from pop culture, Schrödinger's cat.
Right, the idea that a particle, like an electron, doesn't have a single fixed position. It exists in a combination of all possible states at once. It's in state A and state B simultaneously until you measure it.
The standard explanation is usually the cat is dead and alive until you open the box, which, frankly, I've always found annoying. It feels like a riddle, not an explanation. It makes physics sound like wizardry.
I completely agree. It makes it sound like magic. But let's use the 3D to 2D analogy because it strips away the magic and shows the geometry. Imagine the sphere is hovering just above the flatland paper.
Okay. He's hovering 2 inches above the square's house.
And let's say, because he's a 3D object, he's essentially everywhere relative to the flat plane below him. He has the potential to touch the paper at point A or point B or point C. He isn't restricted to one spot on the paper yet.
But the square can't see him yet.
No, to the square, the space is empty. But the presence of the sphere is there. It's a potential. It's a probability field. In quantum physics, we call this the wave function.
So the wave function isn't the particle itself smearing out like peanut butter across the universe.
Not exactly. Think of it as the sphere's shadow or influence hovering in a higher dimension. It describes the probability of where the sphere will appear if he decides to dip down. It's a potentiality.
And the moment he dips down.
Bam. He touches the paper. The square sees the circle at a specific spot. We call that the collapse of the wave function. We force the 3D entity to show up in a specific 2D location.
That actually makes so much sense. The particle was always real, but it was existing in a way in a higher dimension or a probability state that we couldn't see until we forced it to intersect with our slice of reality.
Exactly. The measurement is just the slice. We're forcing a multidimensional event into our 3D coordinate system, and it looks weird because we're losing information in the translation.
Okay, let's try another one. The uncertainty principle. Heisenberg.
This one is often misunderstood, too. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle states you cannot know the position and the momentum of a particle at the same time with perfect precision. If you know exactly where it is, you have no idea where it's going or how fast.
I always thought that was a clumsiness issue. Like if we just had smaller tweezers or better microscopes, we could measure both. It feels like a failure of technology.
That's the common misconception. People think it's a failure of our tools, but it's not. It is a fundamental property of nature. And Flatland explains why perfectly.
How? Break that down for me.
Imagine the sphere is moving rapidly through the sheet of paper. He's zooming through at a 45-degree angle, just passing through the plane.
Okay, he's a fast-moving 3D object crossing the 2D world.
Now, you are the Flatland scientist. You want to measure his position. To do that, you have to take a snapshot. You have to freeze the frame to see exactly where the circle is on your paper at a specific microsecond.
Right. I need a static coordinate, X and Y. I need to pin it down on the grid.
But if you freeze the frame to get the precise location, what do you lose?
I lose the movement. I just have a still image of a circle. I don't know if it was growing, shrinking, or moving left. I've stopped the tape.
Exactly. You've isolated the position, but you've destroyed the information about the momentum. Now flip it. If you want to measure the momentum, the speed, and direction, you have to watch the movie. You have to watch the circle grow and shrink and shift over time to calculate the trajectory.
But if I'm watching the movie, the circle is changing every microsecond. I can't pin down a single position because it's a blur of motion.
You have to trade one for the other. Because the reality is a 3D object moving through a 2D plane. The 2D plane cannot capture the full 3D truth of position and momentum simultaneously. It's a dimensional limitation.
That is wild. It's not that the particle is being difficult. It's that our slice of reality literally isn't big enough to hold all the information at once.
The data exists, but it exists in a higher dimensional state. The sphere that can't be fully compressed into our lower dimensional view of the square.
All right, I'm totally sold on the analogy. Let's do the big one, the one Einstein famously hated, entanglement.
Spooky action at a distance.
Right. This is where two particles are linked. You separate them by a galaxy. You flip one up, the other flips down instantly, faster than light. It breaks the rule that information can't travel faster than light.
In classical physics, yes. It looks impossible. It looks like magic communication. But look at it from Flatland. Imagine the sphere holds up two fingers, like a peace sign, and he touches the paper with the tips of those two fingers.
What does the square see?
He sees two separate circles, two distinct entities, maybe they're feet apart on the paper. To the square, there are two different objects, totally unconnected. There is empty space between them.
But then the sphere twists his wrists.
Instantly, both circles on the paper rotate simultaneously.
And the square goes, oh my God. Telepathy. Magic. How did Circle A tell Circle B to move instantly? They're feet apart. There was no signal.
But in 3D?
In 3D, they aren't two objects. They're part of the same hand.
They are connected in a higher dimension. The separation is an illusion of the 2D plane. The sphere doesn't need to send a signal from one finger to the other. They're part of the same structure.
That gives me chills. So entanglement might just be us seeing two fingertips of a higher dimensional object.
That is the leading philosophical implication here.
Yeah.
What we see as separation or distance might be an illusion of our dimension. In the underlying reality, the quantum realm, everything might be connected in ways our 3D brain simply cannot map. We're seeing islands, but we don't realize they're all connected by the ocean floor.
So we really are the Flatlanders.
We are. And quantum mechanics is simply the sphere bumping into our furniture.
This ties back perfectly to the correspondence principle mentioned in the source. It basically says that classical mechanics, Newton, apples falling, billiard balls hitting each other, is just an approximation. It works for big, slow stuff.
Just like Flatland geometry works fine as long as you don't look up. Our classical physics is a great map for our daily life. It builds bridges, it flies planes. But once you look closely at the atomic level, the rules of Flatland break down. We see the limitation of our grid.
Another great example of this from the text is the double slit experiment where light behaves as both a wave and a particle. It defies our binary logic. It has to be A or B, right? But in the quantum realm, it's both. Or neither, depending entirely on the slice we take.
Depending on how the sphere passes through.
And that limitation brings us to the second half of our deep dive, because if our perception is this limited in physics, imagine how limited it is in our daily lives, in our relationships, in our society.
Oh yeah, we aren't just misreading electrons, we are misreading each other.
This is where we leave the physics lab and enter the philosophy department. We're bringing in the holoscript.
Yes, we've established that reality with a capital R is weird. Weirder than we can perceive. Now we have to look at why we struggle with this.
The source here is The Holoscript, A Manifesto on the Limits of Human Reality by H.D.H.J. Stolting. The author uses a metaphor that I found really helpful. The inkblot and the grid.
It's a very powerful image. Imagine reality, the universe, existence, as the room you're sitting in right now, is a giant, continuous, formless inkblot. It's just stuff. Energy, swirling chaos. It's a continuum.
It has no lines. It has no this or that. Nature doesn't draw borders between countries. Nature doesn't label a weed versus a flower. A weed is just a plant we decided we don't like.
Right. Those are our inventions. But humans cannot function in chaos. We would go insane. If we saw the raw ink blot, we could make a cup of coffee. So what do? We lay a grid over the ink blot, like graph paper.
And suddenly we can coordinate. We say, look, that's square B4. That's a tree. That's a felony. That's a profit.
We project the grid. But here's the mistake, the fatal mistake. We confuse the grid with the ink blot. We think the lines are actually out there in nature, but the lines are only in our heads.
The source calls this distinction the world versus reality.
Exactly. Reality is the ink blot. It's the raw sensation, the physical truth. The world is the grid. It's the map we drew. And the holoscript is the software that generates the grid. It's our language, our logic, our culture. It's the speeding train we started the show with.
So we're looking at the ink blot through this grid. And we think the grid is the reality. We think the map is the territory.
And this leads to a very specific mechanism that the author calls PSE, the principle of systematic exclusion.
That sounds incredibly technical, like something from a robot manual.
It sounds technical, but it's actually very intuitive. It's the idea that nature works by forgetting.
Explain that, because I feel like nature remembers stuff. We have DNA, we have fossils. Nature seems to keep receipts.
Nature remembers what works. But think about how it gets there. Think about evolution. How does evolution create a perfect shark?
By killing off everything that wasn't a perfect shark.
Exactly. It systematically excludes the failures. The mutations that didn't swim fast enough, gone. The chemical combinations that didn't form stable cells in the early ocean, dissolved. Excluded.
The source calls these Darwin's dragons.
I love that term. Darwin's dragons are the millions, billions of potential evolutionary paths that didn't happen or that started and failed. They're excluded. Nature is a subtraction machine. It chips away everything that isn't viable.
So reality is defined by what is missing. The shark exists because the not shark failed. The universe is a sculpture made by removing the marble that didn't fit.
Yes. What remains is coherent because everything incoherent has been related. It's a forgetting system. It sustains only what is viable without any moral judgment, just structural coherence.
But humans, we don't forget.
And that is the human rupture. That is where we break the rule of nature. We have memory.
We have libraries and language and the cloud. We archive everything.
We keep the dragons. We can imagine things that don't exist. We can maintain concepts that are not viable in nature. We can build entire systems of logic, ideologies, bureaucracies, neuroses that would naturally fall apart if they were subject to the raw elements. But we prop them up with our minds. We create artificial life support for bad ideas.
So nature is a real-time system. It deals with what is here and now. If it doesn't work, it dies. Humans are an archive system. We keep things alive in our holoscript, even if they don't work in reality.
And that divergence between the natural coherence of the inkblot and the symbolic persistence of our grid is where evil comes from, according to Stolting.
Whoa, okay, that's a big jump, from memory to evil.
The source is very specific here. It's not evil in the sense of a Disney villain laughing in a tower. It's evil in the sense of misery or destruction. It's structural incompatibility. And to explain it, we have to talk about a rooster named Matthias.
I love this story. It feels like a fable. This is the parable of Matthias the rooster.
It's from a Dutch story referenced in the text. So Matthias is a rooster. He lives on a farm.
Yeah.
And he has an abbot. He likes to sit in a specific rut in the dirt road.
It fits his belly perfectly. A nice, comfy, warm rut.
But every afternoon, a milk truck comes down that road.
And Matthias sees the truck coming. He gets scared. He jumps out of the rut. The truck passes. Matthias settles back down. He survives.
This happens every day for years. Now let's look at the levels of reality here. Level N-1 is reality. The ink blot, the physical sensation. Big loud thing approaches, adrenaline spikes, jump, safe.
Simple, cause and effect. The system works perfectly.
But Matthias is a smart rooster. He starts to think. He starts to build a holoscript. He moves to level N, the symbolic level.
He creates a logic. He starts connecting dots that shouldn't be connected.
He reflects on his memory. He thinks, you know, I sit here every day, the truck comes, I jump, nothing ever happens to me, I'm always safe.
He starts to believe that safety is a property of the rut.
Exactly. He confuses the result of his action with the nature of the situation. He creates a rule. I jump, therefore I am safe. But eventually the logic short circuits. He thinks nothing bad ever happens here. This is a safe zone.
He confuses his idea of safety with the territory, the actual road.
One day the truck comes. And Matthias, trapped in his symbolic logic that this is a safe place, doesn't jump. He trusts the grid over the ink blot.
And splat. That is dark. But I see the point. The evil, the destruction didn't come because the truck driver hated the rooster. It didn't come because nature was cruel.
It came because of subversion by logic.
Mm.
SBL. That's the term the author uses. SBL happens when you take a concept that only exists in your head in the holoscript, and you try to force it onto reality as if it belongs there.
Matthias applied his symbolic logic that he was safe to a physical reality where safety is never guaranteed, and the reality crushed him.
Precisely. The concept of safety was preserved in his mind. He was keeping a dragon alive, but it had no grounding against the oncoming truck. This is the definition of SBL. The moment a concept that belongs to the grid is applied to the inkblot.
And the source gives some really biting modern examples of this because we do this all the time. It's not just roosters. We are all Matthias sitting in the road.
Oh, absolutely. Look at ecological management. The text brings this up.
Monoculture.
Yes. We look at a forest, a complex, chaotic inkblot of biodiversity, fungi, bacteria, different trees, chaos. It works, but it's messy. So we apply our grid. We say it would be more efficient, which is a purely symbolic concept, if these were all pine trees in straight rows.
We impose the holoscript on the forest. We make it look like an Excel spreadsheet.
And what happens? The forest collapses. Disease spreads. The soil dies. Because the efficiency is a value in our head, not a law of the forest. The forest runs on resilience, not efficiency. We subverted the reality with our logic. We forced the inkblot to fit the grid, and the inkblot died.
Or look at AI. The Source touches on this, and we talk about it on the show a lot.
We train an AI model on a data set, a closed data set, a world, a grid. The AI learns the patterns of the grid perfectly. It is a genius within the grid.
But then we release it into the real world, the open world.
And it hallucinates.
Yeah.
It fails. It makes catastrophic error. Why? Because it is trying to map the messy, infinite inkblot using the rigid, limited grid it was trained on. It's the holoscript trying to eat the inkblot. It sees a barrier where there is none, or an open road where there's a wall.
In economics, too, the Source mentions the idea of infinite growth.
Growth is a symbolic necessity. Our math requires it. Our stock market requires it. But we apply it to a finite planet with finite resources. The symbol of growth subverts the biological reality of finite limits. The result's climate change, ecological collapse, Matthias staying in the rut because the spreadsheet said he was safe.
It's actually terrifying when you see it everywhere. We are constantly trying to force the universe to obey our spreadsheet logic, and the universe is just waiting with a milk truck.
And this brings us to the misery. The text breaks down a hierarchy of misery that comes from this Matthias's folly. It starts small and gets huge.
It starts internally, right? Inside our own heads.
Yes, internal misery. This is when you apply the holoscript to your own biology.
Like telling yourself I shouldn't be sad.
Exactly. Sadness is the inkblot. It's a chemical biological reality happening in your body. It is a sensation like heat or cold. Should is the grid. It's a logical rule you learned from society.
Yeah.
When you tell yourself I shouldn't be sad, you are Matthias refusing to jump. You are attacking your own biology with your logic.
Because my script says I have a good job, I have a house. Logically, I should be happy.
But the body says, I am miserable. And the war between the two creates anxiety, repression, and neurosis. You are gaslighting yourself. You are telling your internal square that the sphere of sadness doesn't exist.
Wow. Then it moves to relational misery.
This is the big one. The Source calls this the ultimate transgression.
Filling in for another.
Yes. This is when I take my grid and I force it onto your inkblot.
Oh, that describes so many arguments I've had.
It's me deciding what you're feeling based on my logic. You're not angry. You're just tired. You don't mean that you're just reacting to X.
I am projecting my holoscript onto you.
You are denying my reality, my direct experience, and replacing it with your symbol. This is the root of so much conflict. It's the refusal to accept that the other person is a sphere you can't fully see. You are trying to force them to be a circle on your page. You are simplifying them to make them fit your logic.
I love that callback to Flatland. So gaslighting is basically treating a 3D person like a 2D drawing in your own book.
Perfectly said. That is exactly what it is. And then finally, societal misery. Bureaucracy.
Bureaucracy is pure symbol. It is the grid worshiping itself.
It is the grid gone mad. It's a system of rules that is completely detached from human reality. When a starving person is denied food because they didn't fill out Form 14B correctly, that is the holoscript murdering the reality.
The form is the safety rule. The hunger is the truck.
And the system chooses the form over the hunger. That is the ultimate subversion by logic.
So what do we do? This feels heavy. If we're the passenger on the train and we can't get off, are we just doomed to be hit by trucks? Are we doomed to make ourselves miserable?
No. The Source offers a remedy. It doesn't say abandon logic entirely. We need logic to survive. But it calls for discernment.
Which means?
It means we have to stop confusing the map with the territory. We need to acknowledge the levels.
So when I feel something, I need to pause.
You need to ask, is this a symbol or a sensation? Am I reacting to what is actually happening in the truck? Or am I reacting to a story I'm telling myself about it? The rule.
And the text says we need to learn to forget.
This is crucial. We need to manually re-engage the principle of systematic exclusion. We hoard ideas. We hoard grudges. We hoard out-of-date strategies. Mental hygiene means looking at your mental models and saying, does this still work? No. Delete.
Kill the dragons.
Kill the dragons.
Yeah.
If a belief doesn't fit the reality anymore, let it die. Don't be Matthias holding on to a safety rule that expired yesterday.
And there's a great quote about a ladder in the text.
From Wittgenstein, yes. He said, philosophy and all these frameworks we're talking about today are like a ladder. You use them to climb up to a new perspective. But once you're up there,
you throw the ladder away.
You don't live on the ladder. You use the theory to understand, but then you put the theory down and experience the world directly. You look at the ink blot without the grid.
And the strongest takeaway from the source, the ethical commandment here, is do not fill in for another.
It's the antidote to relational misery. It means accepting that you can never fully know the internal world of another person, or a bat,
right,
or a cat, or a proton for that matter.
Just like the square can't know the sphere?
Exactly. You have to respect their ink blot. You have to stop forcing your script onto them. It's an act of profound humility. It's saying, I see you, but I don't own your definition.
That brings us full circle perfectly. We really did connect geometry, physics, and morality.
We did. We started with the square and the sphere.
The square learned that his 2D world wasn't everything. There was a dimension upwards that he couldn't see but had to respect.
Then we went to quantum mechanics,
mm-hmm.
which showed us that matter itself is not solid, but a haze of probability and connection, a sphere passing through our slice of reality.
And we ended with Matthias the Rooster.
Who taught us that relying too much on our logic, our 2D map, can get us killed if we ignore the 3D truck coming down the road?
The connecting thread really is humility.
It is. Whether it's a fourth dimension, a superposition electron, or the feelings of your partner, we have to admit that our grid is never the full ink blot.
Our barriers are always closed, but that doesn't mean the road isn't open.
That's it, exactly.
I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought today, something to chew on. We talked about the passenger on the train at the very beginning. To him, the barriers are always closed. He cannot conceive of an open crossing because his very presence closes them.
Right.
So ask yourself this, what barrier in your life do you think is permanently closed? What is something you think is impossible or forbidden or just the way it is, simply because your train triggers the closure every time you approach it?
That is a haunting question. Is the barrier actually locked? Or is it just your presence, your expectation, your hollow script that slams it shut?
And what would happen if you managed to stop the train?
Or better yet, what would happen if you realized the barrier is just a line on your map, not a wall on the road?
There's a beautiful phrase at the end of the manifesto, the silence after the argument.
The reality that exists before we name it.
Let's try to live in that silence a little bit more this week. Thanks for diving in with us.
See you in the next dimension.
Yes.